Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
I'm John Seibold.
It's great to be back with you again after a couple of weeks. Hopefully you enjoyed our first episode of the season with Will Leach, Matt Tunian, and Yul
Vandred. It was a good one.
We enjoyed it.
When I was listening to it again, I thought we sounded pretty good.
Outstanding.
So well, now the bar's been set, y'all.
Kept Brian and I's friend Jeff Brandt awake over a midnight drive through Wisconsin, so...
Oh. If that's not an endorsement, I don't know what it is.
That's a ringing endorsement right there.
So, busy sports time of year. Things getting underway on college campuses all over the country. U.S. Open tennis
going on right now, Lisa? It's crazy balls.
It is crazy tennis balls. Crazy tennis balls. Yes. So, what's happening is like. What's not happening in a lot of ways, like who isn't there? That's sort of been the big topic of conversation. No Stan Wawrinka, no Novak Djokovic, no Andy Murray. Serena Williams is probably, I bet she's already had her baby and just nobody knows.
Right.
That's, you know, because she doesn't, I don't know. So, and several other injuries. And of course, we're playing through the first rounds of games right now or matches right now and a couple losers that are surprising, especially on the women's side. So it's kind of surprising, like, who isn't there? That's kind of the big story. And I have a lot of feelings about it because when you look at the ages of the people who aren't there, they're all over 30. And so I think we're entering that period of time where there's going to be another transition to some younger players winning the big matches. You know, you already have Magurta on the women's side, who is, she's in her early 20s and she's won a couple big tournaments. You have, I can't remember her first name, Pliskova? Yeah, you know who I'm talking about. She's like 6'1".
Yeah.
She's going to be a major player. So on the women's side, you have some women coming in and filling those gaps. On the men's side, it's a little more iffy. I mean, last night, the guy who was playing Roger Federer eventually lost in five sets to Federer, but like...
He made Roger work.
He made Roger work, and Roger looked terrible in the first... set, I would say. Just sort of like, am I going to stay up for this? Like, I don't know. But, you know, the guy playing against him is American. I can't remember his name. He's like 19 years old. 19.
Tifo.
I'm sorry. Here we go.
Just beat that in later, bro.
Yeah, sorry. I did not put that in my notes because I wasn't sure I was even going to talk about Fed. But anyway, so he actually, and of course, the rumors are swirling. Like, is he actually playing kind of injured?
Something about his back.
John, you sent this great article around to the three of us from the, I think it was the New York Times, about like the re-rise of Roger Federer, where it was just sort of like he's this unicorn, like he's like totally amazing, and now like now that he's actually at the Open, it's sort of like maybe he's hurt, you know. And John McEnroe, of course, who is just terrible. Although I secretly love listening to him because he's so terrible. You know, tennis commentators like whoever's winning at any one time. And so when Federer was losing, they were like really into the American guy. And when Fed was winning, it was just like, of course, you know, he's pouring it back on. So that was interesting. Maria Sharapova is back playing. She got a wild card entry after not getting invited to Wimbledon or the French Open this year. So she's back and she won. She beat Simona Halep, who's the number two seed in the tournament. And she played well. You know, I just don't like her. I don't. And it's funny because my daughter's like, I think just to be a little oppositional, is like, well, I like her after hearing her post-match interview or whatever. The thing is like, there have been several pieces about like what happened, again, sort of revisiting this whole doping thing with her. And there's a piece on Deadspin, and we'll link to it, where this woman decided that she was going to dope like Sharapova. And she was an athlete and a mom and running around. And she was like, Meldonium is awesome. and the thing is like Sharapova has always been known for her cardiovascular fitness, and that is exactly what Meldonium does, is it helps your endurance. And also this woman said, you are not sore after going hard. So
wow.
So, you know, she's like, performance enhancing drugs, yay. You know, like in regular life or whatever. Lots of different takes in the comments of that that piece. So, yeah, that's what's happening at the U.S. Open. And we're just underway. So by the time we're back with our next podcast, it'll be over.
All right. Awesome. So we'll check in and talk about champions and whatnot, I'm sure.
Champions.
Yeah. And in addition, It's a busy sports time for you. You went up and saw a soccer match up in Chicago.
Chicago.
And a little bit of an unexpected outcome up there.
Yes. So my family, we are huge Minnesota United Football Club fans. They are an expansion team, and they are terrible. Mm-hmm. Absolutely terrible. They came to Chicago with a 0-8-2 road record. Mm. Terrible. They had never in their entire MLS life, which is this season, won a road game. And we got up to Toyota Park. There are five of us in our Minnesota United gear, and one of us wearing a red shirt, our friend Ed, because he's from Chicago.
Well, yeah.
So we sat in a somewhat chill but potentially hostile section of Chicago supporters. The Minnesota United fan group, which numbered probably around 300, maybe more people.
Oh, wow, that's impressive.
Drums, flags, shirtless people screaming. They had several buses come down. And they actually dominated the Chicago fan section. I'm making air quotes because, like, what fan section?
Oh,
you
wow.
could not really even tell that they had one. Anyway, Minnesota won that game 2-1. Mm. It was awesome. A brace of goals by a young man with the name of last name of Dunlady, Abu Dunlady, I think is his name. And they were beautiful, totally legit goals. It was really nice to see Sebastian Schweinsteiger. He used to play for Manchester.
Schweinsteiger
used to play for Manchester United, German national team. I think German national team. Yeah, it was, and you could tell who he was on the field. Very capable player, different style of play. Anyway, it was great. Minnesota, won the match. I will say I love Toyota Park. It's a great place to see a soccer game. They play on real grass, which I love. It's a cute little park and is in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Yeah.
It's like not that easy to get to. The parking lot is mostly gravel and is a fair amount of anarchy afterward. It's great to tailgate there. That was kind of nice, you know, just kind of hang out ahead of the game and meet a lot of other fans. I really liked the experience of the game there. And it was also Star Wars night. So there were a lot of people dressed up like Darth Vader and
Stormtroopers.
Lots of Stormtroopers. And I have some photos from that. And they gave away a commemorative scarf, and mine is coming in the mail. Wasn't able to get there in time to get one. But it was really cool. But I just wish that you could get to a pro soccer match without having – there's no public transportation out there either.
Right.
So I think it would be so much better even for Chicago soccer if their park were located somewhere else.
Yeah, like downtown, it was somewhere around the downtown area would be cool.
Yeah.
Somewhere around Soldier Field or something.
Almost everywhere else, there's like stuff going on nearby too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there, once you leave Toyota Park, you're just trying to get out of the area to go find something else to do.
Yeah,
so,
you're just kind of in the burbs there.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I've been there once, and like you said, I thought it was a nice park. I went and saw the Red Stars play once several years ago when Ella Masser was playing for them. Nice park, great place to watch a game, but yeah, you have to take like surface streets for a ways to get there.
Yeah.
Lots of lights.
Yeah. But it was a really good experience. And we also had the experience of seeing Minnesota United win its first road game. So
history.
That was kind of nice. Yeah. So we were at the first game for the franchise, the first home game for the franchise. We'll be at the last home game for the franchise this year on October 7th and saw the first road win. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. And I'm really looking forward. I know they're trying to build a rivalry between the two teams. And I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever. You just got to let that organically come along.
That'll
and maybe
help.
Our fan section, like totally dominating their fan section and being audible on like on the TV, on the broadcast. That might help, but we're looking forward to that match next year for sure. And hopefully they'll play twice. They only played each other once this year. So, yeah, it was awesome.
Awesome. So there's your...
Thanks for letting me natter on about it.
You bet. Yeah. There's your Minnesota United report from...
a little bit of Chicago Fire. Yeah. I want them to do well, you know, and just as an aside, they were doing really well. They were near the top of the table. They've lost like 6 games in a row or something. And nobody can really explain the skid. And, of course, I'm looking here at the Athletics website, the little prelude to their story about it. And... you know, they're like so embarrassed that they lost to Minnesota. But I thought we played really well. So anyway.
All right. Very cool. So thanks for that, Lisa.
Sure.
A lot more to come here on this episode of The Bandwagon. We've got our controversy still to come, also our status update. But first, we'll talk with John Greenberg. He's the founding editor of The Athletic Chicago. We've talked from time to time about how sports writing seems to be evolving right now, and John is certainly up close and personal to that. So we'll talk to John Greenberg coming up next here on The Bandwagon. John Greenberg is the founding editor of The Athletic Chicago, a website that started up just over a year ago. And here in the last couple of months, The Athletic is really growing quite a bit, going national with some very well-known writers, in addition to their local coverage in several markets as well. And John Greenberg joins us to talk about The Athletic right now. Thanks for joining us, John.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you could, take us back, you know, here a little over a year ago when The Athletic got started there in the city of Chicago. How did it all come about?
It's pretty interesting, actually, and it's a good lesson for job seekers out there. Occasionally, you should check LinkedIn, which is something most journalists don't even, you know, barely use. But it's funny, I had set up an account a year before where I had to kind of put basically two jobs and one was ending, so I was looking for new stuff. And then in 2015, at the end of September, basically found out that ESPN wasn't going to renew my contract. I had an option picking up, and this is before the great bloodletting at ESPN. So I was kind of a ESPN layoff hipster, if you will. I did it before it was cool. So I found out, and I was kind of, you know, I spent a few months and was looking around, and I got an email from a guy on LinkedIn that I never heard of, asking if I'd be interested in talking about working for a new sports website. He didn't even know I was laid off. And I was immediately skeptical, obviously. But I talked to him anyway because I didn't really have a lot of options at that point. And I was instantly impressed. These two guys, Adam and Alex from San Francisco, entrepreneurs that met at a startup there, had a really good plan. They had a good name. The layout of the pages looked professional, which really impressed me that they put in all this work. And so we talked for about a month or so, and we agreed on a salary and basically agreed to do this. I had to quit my other job I had to start one of the other jobs and set about to kind of start this site. And it's kind of funny because, you know, when we started, you know, I basically that January started writing stories so we'd have a backlog. So it was really just me and a couple other guys just sitting in our houses or coffee shops or whatever, just kind of putting story after story after story out. We didn't do any advertising or any marketing ahead of it. We just launched one day. And, you know, a few people knew that I was friends with, but no one really, it was just really out of the blue. We surprised Chicago with it. And it was just a couple of just that basically three writers that were, you know, full-time or on contracts. And we just kind of worked at it. It was pretty crazy if you think about it now that, you know, we hired Ken Rosenthal. We have, like, every hockey writer in existence. All these Sports Illustrated guys from Paul Feitenbaugh, who was ex-SI editor, who they brought on as a consultant and then as an employee, kind of constructed this national team. But, yeah, it really started, my wife and I joke, it was me typing out, you know, stories at our kitchen table and, you know, we had writers going places, practices, and then, you know, it really took off last year.
So this is Lisa. So the moral of the story is check your LinkedIn account once in a while.
Right. You never know what's going to happen.
So my question is about that, the difference between working in startup culture to where you are now. How has it been different? Because it's all happened in this very truncated period of time. So I'm curious to know what the vibe is like doing that work now as opposed to back then. You sort of hinted at that as you were talking just now, but is there a big difference? Is there a difference in the vibe? It's not just a couple people typing at their kitchen tables anymore. This is a much larger thing. So what's the vibe like now? How's it different?
It is. It's crazy how much we've grown because, you know, for a while, The Athletic was just us. It was just Chicago, you know, and then Toronto. And then all of a sudden, just, you know, all these other sites came popping up. So now these chats we have in Slack, you know, you almost, I understand how people in startups, like, love it. And I understand why people leave, you know, when they get successful, because it is a different feeling. Because you go from being, like, kind of the center of the universe when you start to, like, hey, they're hiring people I don't even know. They're not even telling me. Because I'm literally just in charge of Chicago. And I, you know, ask my advice on stuff occasionally. But it's amazing how fast it's grown. We have all these, I was thinking about the other day, like, man, I'm coworkers with all these people. You know, it's really like there's authors I've enjoyed reading over the years that are, you know, messaging in Slack, different writers. The growth has been incredible because, you know, I think back to Toronto launched last September, and it was a kind of a soft launch. And they really got going in December when James Myrtle, their editor, came aboard, and he and I went to New York to meet with our bosses and meet with one of the investors and just kind of have this small meeting. And it was really just the four of us in an Airbnb, like kind of close to Broadway. The Jersey Boys sign was outside our whatever apartment we were Airbnb-ing from. So, and now, you know, we have all these cities and all these national writers. It's pretty incredible.
For folks out there who maybe aren't quite familiar with what The Athletic is and what it's providing, could you describe it? I mean, there's been a ton of articles, especially now that you guys have picked up some of these national writers, about what you're trying to accomplish, what the site is trying to accomplish. But can you talk a little bit how it works in each city and what the national writers will be covering, which would be different than, say, what they might have been doing at ESPN or Sports Illustrated?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny you mentioned all the stories people have done. We hired a Bears writer from another outlet in town, and when he got hired, one of the other Bears writers was like, "Does this mean you're going to start writing stories on the future of journalism every day?" So, you know, we got a kick out of that because we do get a lot of calls. But, yeah, so basically the way it was described to me and where it's evolved in is just wanted to do daily local journalism at a slight, I'll say a higher level. You know, we don't have to worry about the minutiae. We can, but, you know, that's not why people are subscribing. We want to do some deeper pieces, you know, some heavy, not heavy analytics, but analytical. We don't just want to say someone is bad or someone, you know, should get fired or whatever. We want to have some space to have more details about it. Maybe try to explain the whys a little bit more. You know, I think why is the most important, you know, probably question in journalism. So we try to make that the basis of, you know, at least our biggest stories. You know, we don't talk down to the readers. You know, I know a lot of papers and a lot of places in big markets, you'll find like columnists telling the fans why they're dumb, you know, why they're wrong for thinking this and why, you know, or why a coach is wrong for saying something or a player's wrong. We don't really, you know, we have columnists and I'm a columnist and we do, you know, occasionally stir it up a little bit, but we really want to educate our readers, and we want to take them inside the clubhouse and, like we said, explain the whys a little bit. And, you know, we think my bosses bet on local journalism just because that's, you can see how the papers and the staffs shrink. You know, it's Chicago especially. Like, I've been here since 2003, and, you know, the staffs are like half the size when I got here. And we wanted to bring a little more energy, a little more vitality into some of the conversations, into, you know, what people can get. And one thing that's great about our site is you can go on our site and go on our app and you're not going to get pop-ups. There's no advertising. And it's not just the annoyance of the pop-ups. It's, you know, what they're putting onto your computer, frankly. You know, it's really tough to read the Sun-Times and the Trib. I think anyone, you know, even the writers tell you that. So we're trying to make it a little more streamlined. And then when you go to the national stuff, you know, I mean, like, we're so heavy locally. Like, Maple Leafs, I joke, have, like, 9 beat writers on our Athletic Toronto site. You know, we're going to add more and more in Chicago, too. But, you know, and then the national site is something that's really kind of, we didn't expect to happen. But it was kind of a natural outgrowth. You know, with all these college football and basketball writers getting laid off at SI and ESPN and Fox Sports, it seemed like there was a growth in, you know, there was a growth there. There's a way to kind of come in and grow and take over where there was a shortage of writers now. So that's where that came about. And then the national site, The Athletic, Inc., we just hired Ken Rosenthal. Kind of the same thing. Ken was, you know, not writing anymore at Fox Sports. And, you know, we all kind of had the idea at the same time when he announced that to try to get him. And I wish I had to say I had a huge part in it, but I didn't. But I definitely told my bosses he's a guy, a national writer that local writers respect. You know, we want to still stay true to our roots as a local company. And it's kind of funny because now when we started, it was really odd because, you know, I had a Bulls season credential from ESPN when we started. Scott Powers, our Blackhawks writer, had a Blackhawks season credential as the beat writer. And neither team would honor them when we started because they're like, we don't know what this site's going to be. Is it going to be around? I heard a lot from people that we don't credential online only, which, you know, seems a drastic misreading of the market. Now, the teams mostly come around. We still have a few limitations for some random teams, but it's fascinating now. We have writers from every market emailing us, asking us if they're going to launch. We're going to launch there if they could be hired. So it's a huge 180 since in the year and a half since we started.
Yeah, and John, you know, the conventional wisdom for a long time with really any journalism was that, you know, you have to make it all free. People will not
right.
pay to read news articles, sports articles. They won't do it. Why do you think that paradigm might be shifting, and how successful has the subscription model been for you so far?
So that's a great question. It's the paradigm is shifting for some news consumers, the more educated news consumers, the people who actually think about what they're getting and, you know, have an understanding of what, you know, how the world works. They're starting to be like, all right, we got to pay for things. Now, I've always paid for stuff. I mean, I'm hesitant on some things I'm not going to subscribe to, but I've always paid for the New York Times. You know, I used to get a ton of magazines. Now it's just the New Yorker. You know, and I paid for the Trib at times. You know, it's people understand that, I think. And I think younger consumers get it even more. They're used to paying for things on their phone maybe that some other people aren't. And they're starting to get like this almost boutique, you know, I'll use that word, boutique style that we're putting in. Like they want to be part of something different, you know. And I think there's other sites that have done this before, have made a community of it. You know, I think public radio has done a great job of making a community out of their listeners. I was a WBEZ subscriber for a long time in Chicago. I think that's something that, you know, we can take from public radio and take from other sites is you want to create this community so people feel like they're part of something special, not just subscribing for a service. So we'll have parties and things like that. But it is still tough. You know, there are a lot of – we talk about how many millions of sports fans are in Chicago. Well, a lot of them we'll get the tweets like, why would I pay for this? And some people, you'll say, well, you know, you want quality and stuff. They'll be like, no, I just don't believe in paying for journalism. And you'll wonder, like – some of these people were around before the internet. Did they just steal newspapers? You know? Do they just take them off porches? I don't understand like how you don't get that you have to pay for things. So I think it is shifting. And I honestly, as sad as this is to say, as an ESPN, you know, former ESPN employee, and I've had friends who've lost their jobs, when ESPN basically started firing people this year, that it created a lot of attention for our business because then people realized, well, ESPN, this is the gold standard in free journalism that your cable dollars are basically paying for. It can't support all these writers. We're going to have to start paying.
Right. So as this concept continues to evolve of The Athletic, who do you consider your biggest competition in terms of coverage or type of coverage? You know, there, I think, you know, Vice does some good sports stuff where mm-hmm. they've maybe added video. So do you see a competitor on the horizon, or do you not even think about that?
Well, no, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, I came from ESPN Chicago, and that's where I worked before, and that was a lot more of a startup than people realize. We didn't really have we had ESPN backup stuff. We didn't have great resources just for us. So our competitors then and now are the Tribune, the Sun-Times, Comcast Sports in Chicago, national writers when it comes to the playoffs. We don't want, you know, national people having Cubs stories that we don't have. You know, we're there every day. We should be competitive in a lot of that stuff. That's who our competition is. And for the national sites, the college football site, it's, you know, it is ESPN. It is, you know, New York Times and other outlets. You don't want to get scooped on stuff. So if people are going to pay for us in the market, we've got to show that we're going to give you stuff that the Tribune and sometimes won't. You know, that's our biggest goal is to stand out so much that people will say, you know what, if I'm going to subscribe to something, I'm going to subscribe to The Athletic before the Tribune. And that's not easy to do. And that is our challenge.
Well, John, I'm going to let you go here in just a second, but notice this week you're on beat writer duty at The Athletic with Sahad of Sharma. Looks like he's getting a little vacation. So what's it like being back on beat writer duty?
Well, you know what? I because we're such a small staff, I do that a pretty decent amount. The other editor on our site, Lauren Commentor, and I are basically Sahad's backups. I've been doing that, you know, since last year. You know, it's funny, when I was at ESPN Chicago as a columnist, I would volunteer, you know, to help out with doing the beat. It's all pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. And I think being around is always my favorite thing. You learn, I could write columns in my office every day, but being at the ballpark and talking to people, you know, is obviously a great advantage. And it's like having access is something I don't take for granted. So, yeah, sometimes the funny thing when Todd is gone, though, I do have to – usually I don't go to Joe Madden's press conference before games. Unless I really need something, I go try to hang out in the field and see if I can grab someone. But I got to be a little more responsible. And I'd stay. I actually – you know, columnists, we sometimes we get to leave early if we get something early in the pregame, and I had to stay till the bitter, or not the bitter, it was a good end yesterday for the Cubs, but I did have to stay till the end just in case, not to let Tejada down.
All right, very good. John Greenberg, the founding editor of The Athletic Chicago. Hey, John, thanks a lot for taking some time for us today.
No, thanks for having me. These are great questions.
Thanks again to John Greenberg for joining us to talk about The Athletic and how long-form sports writing seems to be coming back a little bit in vogue right now.
Interesting to see how they do.
Yeah, it is. It is. Seems to be going well so far for them. Wish them the best. They certainly have a lot of talented writers who've come on board here, especially national writers here in the last few months. Time now for our latest regular segment, Controversy. And this week, John Steinbacher has our item of interest. What's going on, John?
Well, it's this is obviously topical for two reasons from national news. One is the U.S. Open, and two, there's a lot going on with trans people in the military. So I thought this would be an interesting one to bring up. For older folks, those being I probably 55 and above, and I don't mean like you're old, I just mean you're older than other people. Oh my gosh.
You're keep quick, digging, John.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I'm over 40. I'm one of us now. This is probably a well-trodden story, but for me, I actually didn't really know too much about it, and I know that apparently there was an ESPN 30 for 30 about it. But there was a tennis player in the late 70s named Renee Richards who basically came to prominence, was not a very great player, was 42 years old, but came to prominence when it because she had a surgery and grew up a man until she was 42 years old, 42-year-old ophthalmologist. I'm sure lots of people know the story well, but basically she was never happy as a man. She got divorced, decided right around 40 that she had always felt like she was a woman, had the surgery, started living her life as a woman. I think was playing in some – she always was a lifelong tennis player. I think she played – was maybe even the captain of the Yale team in college. Was playing some tournaments, was having enjoying it, and then someone found out that she used to be a man, and it became a big deal, especially, I think, at some semi-professional tournament, maybe in New Jersey. Then it became sort of a controversy, you know, it became a big story. And according to Renee Richards, she was never really interested in playing in the U.S. Open. Apparently, she had done it as a man, as an amateur, before it actually became the official U.S. Open. But because it became the story and people were like, she can't play, I think the tournament that she tried to play, 34 of the women's players dropped out because they thought it was unfair. Mm. So she decided to, I think more or less to, as a, you know, I'm a woman, you know, I deserve to play if I want to play. She decided to try and play in the U.S. Open. The U.S. Open instituted a, I forget what it is, like a gender chromosome test for all women. And, of course, hers came back neutral. So she sued, or not sued, but went to court to try and gain entrance. It was obviously a big trial. It obviously moved very fast. She won the trial, and interestingly enough, one of the few people who at the time came out in her favor was Billie Jean King, who obviously is famous for the Battle of the Sexes. Mm-hmm. We can go through that a different time, or maybe we've already done it.
I think we did, yeah.
In the first round, she played Virginia Wade, and apparently Wade had some trash-talking. And she said, I've practiced with a lot of 40-year-old men. If Renee beats me, she should be checked out. And there was a lot of trash talking going on, but Wade ended up winning in straight sets. And after that, things cooled down a bit. Wade actually, I think, won the U.S. Open that year. After this big thing, things cooled down a bit, and apparently Richard became actually pretty good friends with everyone, including Wade. Once she was around for a while, she played on the tour for a couple years. She was never, you know, great, but competitive, and I think she did pretty well in doubles. She actually went on to become Martina Navratilova's coach for a few years, which mm-hmm. is very interesting. Mm-hmm. She's still alive and gets interviewed from time to time. Again, there was that ESPN 30 for 30 piece. But I think, you know, in all the interviews, she said she was not, like, wanting... She never wanted to win, expected to win, or anything like that. It was more about the fact that she wasn't allowed to compete. And I think this is a really interesting story, now that everything else is going on, including even Caitlyn Jenner. Is it Caitlyn or
Caitlyn?
Caitlyn Jenner. It's a pretty interesting piece of history. I'll have to check out the 30 for 30. Certainly still relevant, still interesting.
There are two things that interest me about this. And as I was telling you off mic earlier, I've always heard the name Renee Richards, but I never knew that there was a story behind her name. Mm-hmm. And I watched tennis as a kid and probably watched her play, and it just never occurred to me. So this was really interesting. Two things that interested me. One is just about her continued ambivalence about trans athletes now.
That was interesting.
You know, because she felt that she could be a good competitor because of her age, and that if she had been 23 years old trying to compete against a bunch of 23 years old, that, you know, physically she probably would have dominated them. So I thought that was interesting. And I think she mentions this in one of the articles, and we'll link to both of the articles that you sent us too. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was like how she was discovered, like because somebody recognized a very distinctive part of her serve. I think she's left-handed, and also she's 6'2" tall. And how she had been able to play without being found out for so long. That would never happen now.
No.
Like, I'm just thinking about how every photograph is scrutinized, you know, like you've got this whole army on social media of people who scrutinize every photo or look at every second of video. And like, nobody would ever be able to get away with something like that now because everything is just so visible and viral and out in the world. So that was, but it was really interesting. So thank you for bringing that.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting because before she transitioned, she was a very successful, sort of East Coast, you know, whatever you would call elite, living obviously as a doctor, mm-hmm. living a nice lifestyle. So, and some of the stuff I read, they talked about how, you know, she was unhappy and became suicidal and transitioned, but based on that comfortable lifestyle, maybe things were easier for her than if she had been, right. You know, coming from a different background.
Sure.
But anyway, certainly interesting story, and the response back then and the response now, you know, some ways we've come a long way and some ways we haven't.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Thank you very much, John.
Yeah, thanks.
And as always, we will close out this week with our status update, what stood out to each of us on social media this week. Who wants to kick things off? Lisa?
Sure. So mine's really simple and short. It's just a nice little video that I ran across via Mashable, via Twitter, about a groundskeeper, groundskeeper for the Baltimore Orioles, mm-hmm. who is only the second female groundskeeper in Major League Baseball.
Wow.
And it's a cool little video. And she starts off by saying, you know, when she came to work for the Orioles, just as like not the groundskeeper, but sort of joined the organization from the bottom up. Somebody told her, like, there's one other female groundskeeper in the major leagues. And she said, I'm going to be the second. And here she is, the second. So it's
awesome.
It's a cool little video. I just really enjoy stories like that. And I feel like those folks need to get props because they do amazing work.
Absolutely. Very cool. John, you mind if I go next?
No, I don't mind at all.
Well, a fun one. And it kind of goes along with some of what we were talking about with John Greenberg. This is definitely a long read. If you're familiar with the writer Jonah Carey, he writes about baseball for CBS. He's been writing for them for a while. But he is a very well-known Montreal Expos fan from way back when. In fact, he's probably best known for being one of the guys who advocated the hardest for Tim Raines to make it into the Hall of Fame. But he had kind of a throwback story that he put up last week on CBS. The headline, that time Tommy Lasorda got the Expos mascot tossed out of a 22-inning, 1-0 game. And it's one of those kind of cool, fun, oral history-type stories, remembering back to it was a game in 1989, so it was the year after the Dodgers had won the World Series. Both teams were competitive, but neither team really had much offense, so you get a 22-inning, 1-0 game. And the highlight of it was that the Expos mascot, an orange fuzzball named Yuppie, basically made it his mission that night to get under the skin of Tommy Lasorda, and he did. Apparently, the dugouts at Olympic Stadium in Montreal kind of had this very loud metal on top of them. So Yuppie started just basically jumping up and down on the top of the dugout of the Dodgers until Lasorda came out and started yelling at him. This went on for a while. Then I think about the 10th or 11th inning it was, Yuppie was just laying on top of the Dodgers dugout. Lasorda came out, peeked up on top of the dugout, and called the umpire over, and the mascot got ejected.
So what I enjoy this story because I think to myself of how probably the guy playing, or woman, whoever, playing the mascot, and Tommy Lasorda unknowingly probably had an interlude earlier that day, like Lasorda gave that person an autograph, or they enjoyed a Coke together at the, you know, I just think it's funny. Like, what if that had happened?
Yeah, it was a very amusing story. So we'll link to that in our web article. I highly recommend it from Jonah Carey. That's my status update for this week.
Good one,
Mr. Steinbach.
Well, we are sports and culture, and when you talk about sports and culture in Champaign-Urbana, there is a giant elephant in the room, and that would be the former Native American symbol / mascot of the University of Illinois Fighting Illini football team, which doesn't seem to want to go away. And this, as I'm sure as you're both aware, this week, though the rollout was pretty terrible, the university announced that they are no longer performing the war chant, which is a something played at all the sporting events, all U of I sporting events, probably the last 40 years. I say probably most famously at football games, though they use it in men's basketball, women's basketball. And then this week, I also did it at the soccer game and then immediately got shut down. And that's apparently how they decided to announce it, which not the greatest.
Yeah.
To this morning, Tom Kasich from the News Gazette, who's an excellent reporter for them, who mostly focuses on politics and interesting local things going on, published an article about how the war chant actually originated, the drum beat from the war chant originated on the Captain Kangaroo TV show, and it was a cartoon segment called Adventures of Powwow the Indian. I know this is all well-trodden land in this town, and I don't know what else to say about it except for it's insane that we're still to this day fighting over something that actually literally came from a cartoon. Mm-hmm. But it is what it is. I would say, you know, the rollout of this thing has been interesting. They probably should have just gotten rid of a lot of it when they did the
change.
They should just rip the Band-Aid off at the same time. And I understand the politics. I understand the local people. You know, as someone who does fundraising, I don't want to jump into this way too much, but I just think it's time for everyone to move on.
So what did you think of Illinois Athletic Director Joshua Whitman's open letter
I thought it was good. I thought it was fine. I mean, I know he got razzed on both sides, which he probably knew was going to happen. But he's, as far as I know, the first anyone associated with the athletic department to really even talk about this issue in such mm-hmm. a way in any kind of predominant role. They've all kind of just kept their mouth shut, which I'm sure is what they've been told to do. So, I mean, I appreciated the perspective. I appreciated they said when he was a student here, you know, he was into it. And now, you know, he's evolving and he's understanding that, you know, he wants to make, you know, the university, I'll give them credit, despite the rollout, you know, the chancellor said this is about inclusivity, this is about making everyone feel welcome, and, you know, we're going to keep working until we do that. And, you know, it's not going away anytime soon, but a lot of universities have dealt with this a lot quicker and moved on, and it would just be nice to just go watch sports. Wouldn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that's...
That should be the motto for our show, even though it's totally not...
We just want to watch sports. And then talk about them and dissect them.
Yeah, exactly.
From a cultural... Through several different cultural lenses, yeah. Right?
Yes, so. Absolutely. All right, well, thanks for that, John.
It's good, thanks.
Appreciate it. And that will wrap up this edition of The Bandwagon. But first, we've got credits.
We've got credits. So, yeah, the three of us, we want to thank you for joining us on The Bandwagon today. This is our new season. It's a second episode. Episode 39, maybe, something like that. So if you've stuck with us, or even if you're brand new, thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. These days, Bandwagon is supported by several of our friends and colleagues, among them Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, and Automatic Empire, who wrote and performed our brand new theme music. Thank you to everyone. We can't do it without you. Find us on the web, will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. We link to almost everything that we discuss on the podcast there, videos, audios, social media stuffs, much more, lots of articles. You can subscribe to Bandwagon and rate it in iTunes. Rating will really help people discover us, which we would love. But if you don't have iTunes, it's no big deal. You can find us pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcasts, all consonants, no vowels. To get our most recent thoughts on all things sports and culture and occasionally other topics. And just a note, all three of us run that. So it's, if you're getting tweets, you could be getting them from Brian, you could be getting them from me or John. It's fun to play the guessing game. We don't sign our tweets. We sort of act as a unified body. It's kind of fun. We all also have our own Twitter accounts, and you can find those handles at the main Bandwagon account and follow each of us if you want to. We would love that. We also love questions, links, recommendations, etc. for the podcast, so feel free to call our attention to stuff. We will be back, of course, in a couple of weeks for another episode about these sometimes strange intersections between sports and everything else under the sun. Until then, thanks for playing.